This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
Kate, you are in a very long awaited moment. Maybe not this very moment, but in this sort of space across the next couple of days. What's happening? Where are you going?
Okay, yes, I am in total chaos. I have suitcases half packed all around me because I am finally going to this residency, long-awaited residency, which is at the Michael King Writers' Centre in Auckland. And it's through the Varuna, a Varuna Michael King residency. So it's an international residency that I was lucky enough to get in 2021.
So how did you apply for it? They just put out a thing and said, apply? Was that the...
Yeah, so Varuna must have put out the application. And in those ways that you go, oh, yeah, I'll just go for this, I did. So it's a four-week residency. I have actually pushed it back just to three because it was kind of breaking my brain thinking about how to organise it. And it culminates, and part of it is an appearance at the Verb Wellington Festival at the end of it, which is really cool. So yes, I put in an application like you would a grant or any residency application saying what I was going to work on at the time. And of course, things have shifted because I couldn't do it in 2021 because of COVID. But luckily for them and me, I'm still working on that damn novel. So my aim, Catherine, I'm going to say it out loud and here on the podcast, so I am, you know, putting this out to our listeners, that I am going to finish this draft and I have to submit it to my agent before I come home. So,
oh, that's a great goal.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Tell us about the most interesting things. Are the room set up? Are there other people around? And also, how do you get food?
Great questions. So there is one other person. So it's a house and a studio. So I'll be there with one other person at a time. I think that there is a poet there for the first week. These are New Zealand writers. And then for the next 2 weeks, there's another writer. And so shared kitchen, same kind of deal as Varuna, shared kitchen, etc. I think that I told you the last time that I went on a retreat with people from uni, we got catered for, which was just mind-blowingly useful and lucky and amazing because it took that part out of it. And so I have ordered in food. I've ordered this local New Zealand, kind of like a, I think it's called Whoop. You know, they send you the things and you have to cook it. So that's what I have done.
Like a HelloFresh type.
HelloFresh type situation. So I've done that, at least for the first week. Who knows what happens after that? I did put out on Instagram that I was having some trouble with the packing because obviously I have not yet organized a Kobo Kindle situation. So I need to take some real life books and obviously clothes, always an issue. I also have to take, because I'm appearing at this Bad Diaries salon at Verb Wellington, and they ask that you take your physical diary.
Oh, wow.
And the one that I'm going to read from, I think I've decided, is the diary that I kept when I was 16 and went overseas for the first time.
This is the Vikram Seth.
Yeah. And it is filled with, you can imagine earnest little 16-year-old Kate. It's filled with like every single napkin, museum thing, you know, stuck them all in. So that takes up quite a bit of room. But there was some different feedback on Instagram. Laura Alvery, amazing writer Laura Alvery, reminded me of my own advice that I have given on this podcast before, which is for festivals to pack outfits, not just clothes. And that advice, of course, did not come from me, Catherine. It came from Shay originally. So, and she's been panicking on my behalf this week because I haven't been organized with the clothes. And then some other people did also mention two kind of comfy riding outfits to one real world kind of outfit when I, you know, go out in the world. Biggest issue right now, which potentially you can help me with, is whether or not to pack bathers. So some people said,
I would never not pack bathers. Never. Yeah, okay, I take them in hand luggage just in case. Right.
Okay, because my plan is each morning I'll traipse down the hill, submerge myself in the cold water to like get fired up, and then trudge back up the hill to start riding.
Like, is it in the country? Is it in?
It's in Devonport. So okay. A little part of kind of opposite Auckland. You get on ferries. It all looks very delightful and amazing. I'm excited.
It will be very interesting to see how you get along with your housemates. Presumably fine, but
won't it just? Or maybe I'll just hide. You know how extroverted I am. Obviously, everyone knows that. But when I am deep in writing mode, I do tend to go deep into writing mode. So maybe I'll just hide out in my little room and not talk to anyone.
Maybe you'll be the weird housemate.
Yes.
She just stayed in her room.
Oh, my gosh. Imagine if I'm that person that they go back and say there was this crazy chick from Australia there. But I am intending then to let loose when I get to and be a proper festival fairy when I get to Verb Wellington. So that's what I'm doing. And I like a lot of generative stuff because you can't obviously sit there and write all day. So I read this amazing article by Amani Haider, who wrote The Mother Wound, which I haven't read yet, but I'm looking forward to doing
really
it.
Really good cover.
And so she's written an article for KYD on how art enhances her creative practice. So she's an artist as well, a painter. And I was so into the article, which we'll link to, that I booked in for her online course with KYD, which is about incorporating art into your own practice. So it's KYD does those. Yeah.
That.
Yes. So I've got that as generative kind of stuff to do. But that made me think of a little art project that you are doing right now. Can you please tell us about your 100 days comic challenge?
Yeah, this is a self challenge. Actually, I was talking to someone at work who said that they had set themselves 100 days of comic. Well, it wasn't really comic pictures theirs, but 100-day drawing challenge. So I set myself a 100-day comic challenge because I had started doing them as part of the draft for the middle grade novel. I think I'm on day 7. I haven't posted today's today. I'm loving it. It's so much fun.
I'm loving it.
Really enjoyable. It's, I think what's so nice about it is it feels so much more throwaway than a novel in the sense that,
yes,
you know, you don't have to wait. You just put it up and you're done. Like it's.
Yeah, there's something very powerful about that idea of, now I can't remember the guy's name.
Well, it's sort of less investment, right? Like I'm enjoying doing them and some of them I'm really happy with. Obviously across a 100 days, there's going to be variation.
They're very, very funny.
There's something nice about a daily discipline that is relatively quick. At most, it would take sort of half an hour, you know, to do. I find the drawing very hard because I'm not naturally a drawer. Normally I can come up with a concept, but the drawing and making it actually look fitting so that you can match those two things, I think, is the hardest bit. But the instantaneousness of it, like I'm surprised how much I'm enjoying it. I had thought about it for a long time, and in the Writer's Way, doing the morning pages, I kept talking about it.
I love that.
One of the things that Julia Cameron talks to, this idea of you start to see these themes emerging in the Writer's Way, and the comics was a theme.
I love that what you said too about putting it out every day and that kind of idea of throwaway and less pressure.
Yes.
Reminding me of, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, Seth Godin's work, The Practice Shipping Creative Work, and this idea of how when he was doing his blog in the early days, and I think Glennon Doyle talks about this as well with Liz Gilbert in Magic Lessons, is that idea of with a blog or with something that is a challenge, just putting it out every day and getting used to the feeling of release.
It's absolutely it. I mean, he has done a daily blog. I think he still does his daily blog, and he was one of the original bloggers. But I think from a creativity perspective as well, you realize how deep a well is. I mean, obviously I'm on day seven, so it's early days, but yeah, you find stuff and you can set your own parameters thematically, or there's just a lot you can do. I think I'm a fan of the 100 day challenge, and I'm interested to see, because I looked at this friend from works, looked at their first ones compared to their last ones, and the progression in doing something 100 times is.
I'm so excited. Where does 100 days take you to? What is finish date?
Finish date will be in Jan.
Oh, I'm so excited that we can kick off season 6 with looking at you being able to reflect on happened during those 100 true. Days and what your next 100-day challenge might be. Maybe we can
see. I have copied you. I know you always do the hashtag What Kate Read Next.
Yes.
Is that what it is? So yep. I did KC Comics.
With two Cs. It's something I have a buzz.
I didn't think deeply about. Now I wish I had. I mean, it's not too late. As I said, it's only day 7. I could think of a better hashtag, but you think too long on something, it becomes difficult.
Exactly.
So I'm very excited about it.
Before we move on to the things that we are reading and listening and all of those things are consuming, we have a shout out to some new patrons, the very fabulous Festival Mavens. Have you met them yet?
Oh, no, I haven't met them in person, but I've absolutely met them online.
Oh my gosh. Ali and Megan, thank you so much for becoming patrons of our podcast. These two women are seriously that. They just get around to all the festivals. I've seen them host and also just be enthusiastic readers and part of the festival kind of ecosystem. So that's so exciting. Thank you so much to the Festival Mavens for becoming patrons of the show.
Well, I love that. Now, there are so many good books that we are going to get into some of them. But first, we want to go to our featured book, which is My Sweet Guillotine by Jane Tuttle. And we're going to talk to Jane now. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Hardy Grant, and we are very, very excited to be talking to Jane Tuttle about her second book of literary autofiction, My Sweet Guillotine. Jane Tuttle is the author of Paris or Die and My Sweet Guillotine. Paris or Die was developed into a solo theatre show with director John Bolton and performed in 2021 and 2022 in a variety of venues, including La Mama in Melbourne. Jane graduated from the Lecoq Theatre School in 2006 and went on to live and work in Paris as an actor, voiceover artist, playwright, translator, and bilingual copywriter. Jane was awarded the Eric Dark Flagship Fellowship in 2021 from the Varuna Writers House, and she co-owns the bookshop at Queenscliff in coastal Victoria. Welcome, Jane.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Firstly, a massive congrats on My Sweet Guillotine. I feel like I also want to congratulate you on Paris or Die, even though that's been out for a little while. I devoured both of these books in super quick succession and have been raving about them to everyone ever since. We are going to start with what feels like a very poor choice of words in your case, which is the elevator pitch. Can you tell me what My Sweet Guillotine is about?
Oh, God, yeah. I've always been so bad at this. But My Sweet Guillotine is about the fallout, I suppose, ostensibly, of a really freaky accident that happened in Paris involving a descending elevator and myself standing on a stairwell. The Paris or Die begins and ends with the story of this kind of freaky accident. And My Sweet Guillotine really follows on from there as to what happens next. So the character of Jane, is quite familiar, she returns to Paris after this experience and takes up her life as attempts to sort of take up her life as before, carrying this injury and I guess physical and mental, and pushes through, and the ramifications are present themselves in different ways. And yeah, so the elevator pitch is probably too many sentences there, but I guess you'd say near-death experience, freaky thoughts. There you go.
Now, it would be hard to talk about both of your books really without talking about Paris. The city feels like such a character in both books. Is that how you thought about it? And what parts of personality, what parts of Paris's personality did you want to capture?
Yes. Well, that is a huge driver for both of these books. I really had this desire ever since I went there, and particularly the second time I went, when I went to the theatre school and fell in love with this kind of really colourful, exciting, different kind of part of Paris to what I'd experienced when I first went as an au pair and was in a sort of, you know, the typical clean, you know, shiny streets with all the kids in their neat school uniforms and all of that trotting in lines. You know, the second time I went, I arrived in this street, the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Denis, where I was going to theatre school, and it was just such an exciting street to be in, just full of different cultures and different smells and sounds and different kinds of people from all over the planet, all sort of mixed into one, and then in the middle of that, this theatre school. And I think I kind of fell in love with it, and when it came time to leave that for the first time, I remember just wanting to take it with me and needing to try and bottle it. And so, yeah, Paris, the character of Paris was always for me really many different colours and shades, you know. It was a place that was always challenging me. And it did feel to me in lots of ways like it became a character. Just when I would think that I had enough, I couldn't take the administration or, you know, the pollution or something anymore, it would just throw some little sweet thing at me and keep me there. And vice versa, just when I thought I was blissed out, something would come out of nowhere. It's such a changing place. I loved how, you know, walking down the street every day would be an adventure. I guess it's the same as living in any foreign city. You're rendered so humble to your surroundings that you're just taking everything in all the time. And I think it was, yeah, I was fascinated by it. Fascinated enough by it to just want to write every day about the things that I was seeing and experiencing. Yeah.
Part of your relationship to Paris is anchored in the fact that you studied acting there. I'm interested in the relationship between acting and writing. Your training at this theatre school in Paris read on the page as having had a lot of physicality to it, which makes it feel very different from writing. How do you find characters and stories in acting, and is it the same for writing, or is it different?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I never set out to be a writer, actually. I really always dreamed of being an actor ever since I was sort of a kid and found my dad, who worked in television, had scripts everywhere through the house. So I was always picking up scripts and reading these, I guess, even at that stage, like, you know, physical embodiments of writing. So the muscle around the words that were on the page were always in my mind, even from a kid, as full moving beings. And then by the time I went on to drama school, the writing and performing became so entwined. And when I would read, I think I would always see the scene being played out via the body. And then being at Le Coq at the theatre school there, I'd already had inklings that I wanted to write, but then at the Le Coq school, you are writing all the time. You're creating these pieces every week called the autocours, where you stand up in a group and you spent the whole week developing a piece set to a theme. So it could be anything, make us laugh. You have to go away for a week and make a piece that makes us laugh. So you have to write it, you have to direct it, and you have to perform it in this group. So writing is this.
Writing in that scenario, is it actually written or is it
not on the page? Yes, it's an active version. So, yeah, a lot of the time, I mean, some of the pieces wouldn't have any words at all, but, yeah, you would, a lot of it would be done on the floor, but it would still be written. In the second year, when the pieces became a bit more, they were a little bit more in these specific territories such as melodrama and tragedy, and I found that we would come in with words more often, either words that we had, you know, got from somewhere else or stuff that we had actually physically written. And I actually started doing that a lot more. I sort of started taking that role of coming in with writing that I'd developed over the weekend or something, just so we had something to go by. But I actually really loved that side of it. And but to answer your question, I always think that the performing training and the aspect of having worked physically really helps so much in the writing, because it is, maybe it helps with being able to I was going to say like understand what the way that people will say, speak and behave maybe a bit better. Maybe there's that vision of, or that feeling in your body of like, I wouldn't walk that way, or what does, how does he walk? How does he hold himself? What's his pelvis like? You know, so much acting training is about like, what bit of the body does he lead with? And that can be really helpful with describing characters. I never have a character that I'm writing about that I can't see moving through space physically. That's how I, yeah, that's definitely how I see them.
So kind of continuing on that theme of the relationship between acting and writing, one of the sort of devices that you use in My Sweet Guillotine is you have these sections that are written in play form, as in a like a script. Can you talk about the decision to write that way?
Yeah, I've always been really interested in that, in the way that we perform day to day. How are you? I'm fine, you know, and underneath there's this, you know, entire, you know, epic universe, but we're fine on the outside. And I think that in My Sweet Guillotine, one of the main things that happened after the accident was that I was unable to perform. So I just finished the theatre school when the accident happened. It broke my cervical spine, so I basically broke my neck. And afterwards, it wasn't just that I was very fragile around the neck area, which repaired really well with the neck brace that I had to wear, but it was also the fear of unpredictable things happening. So I was worried, I couldn't be bumped. And acting and performing is all about getting in the scrum and, you know, unpredictable things happening is what it's all about. So that aspect of theatre being removed was really interesting to me. And then in the actual book, when it came to trying to go forward in life with this pain, it's even talking about it now I find hard and embarrassing because it's so boring. You know, like we don't really want to know about what's going on inside somebody. So when it came to describing the accident, I really wanted to describe it. I had to describe it in the book, but I didn't want to just write it down. And I thought, what would she do? She would tell the story, and this is how it was definitely for me, and still is. I'm probably doing it right now. I step into my character and deliver the story. And so that really set off that initial scene where someone asks what happened, and the character Jane steps into this role of, okay, you know, take a deep breath. Here we go. So it was January. Paris was dark. You know,
it's so effective. Like, as the reader really feels that, because there's discomfort in it too. that's part, it feels like that's a major driver for this performative element of what had happened. It's such a clever device. I really got a lot from it.
Yeah, thanks. I think it sort of enabled me to really go into places as well that I personally found really hard to go into, like about the lawsuit. And I think that the story being that idea of trying to go forward after this major trauma, you really do split into two people, I think. You know, you split into the person that is sort of curled up and can't, you know, afraid of sudden movement. And then the other person that's like, you know, 31-year-old, ready to go on with their life. Out we go. Oh, I'm brave enough to go and do this lawsuit. Yep, I'll just put on the character, you know, or I'll, you know, I'll go in. This is just pretend it's a theatre set. I think we do that. I know that I've had to do that in my life so much, and I feel like some days that's what it's like every day. Just walking out the door is like, hey, come on, just get in your costume. Put on your big girl.
Yeah, that's right. The book has so many moments of great vulnerability in it, from the trauma of the accident, but also you write about sex and fear and love and relationships. Do you find it hard to write about deeply personal things?
I want to say yes, but probably no, actually. I kind of feel like, I mean, I definitely found this book hard. I found it a lot harder than Paris or Die in lots of ways, just because there were areas that I I'd blocked off that I didn't really want to revisit. But I think that that was also really interesting and fun and curious for me. Like, I'm a bit, I don't know. I feel like I'm sometimes I really wish that I could write things that weren't so deeply personal. But I desperately wish I could. I wish I could sit and imagine and write, you know, write something that wasn't so intrinsic to my every fiber of my being. But I also really enjoy it. I really want to do that. I really enjoy it. I discover so much as I'm doing it, just like I'm researching a story. I mean, this book really was like researching someone else's story in lots of ways, because it happened 10 years ago. Well, actually, gosh, nearly 15 years ago now. It's 2007. So a lot of time has passed, enough for me to almost see it like, that's why I say Jane, you know, it's a little Jane. It's a different person to me. She's so different and gone, you know. Well, she's not gone. She's still there, but she's, you know, she's, it's like looking at another person's story in lots of ways. But I definitely, I think if anything, the only thing I've thought about when I've thought about this book is, did I go far enough? And that terrifies me more than the idea of not having gone to the deepest personal level that I can. I feel like that's my job. I just don't know what else I'm. Yeah,
that's so interesting.
Well,
my Sweet Guillotine will be out by the time listeners hear this. I wonder how. I mean, you've written theatre in addition to acting. You've also written work for the stage. How is it different releasing a book versus releasing something that is performed?
It's so different because, you know, like I just did this play at La Mama a couple of months ago now. And I being on stage, you're immediately aware of what you're creating. You have a flow with your audience that's immediate. And with a book, you know, you release a book and you don't really know. You get feedback, of course, and you get little messages and lovely things, but you don't have that immediate knowledge. You know, in the theatre, no one can hide their, you know, no one can cope their reaction with, oh, I really enjoyed it. What are you writing next? You know, that sort of, you don't have any barrier between you and the writing. And I love that. And that also terrifies me. And I love that with a book is something that will endure. You know, the thing I love about theatre is that it's alive and then it's dead straight away. And that's so sad. It's gone. It can never live again. which is what makes it so thrilling and wonderful as an art form. But also it's tragic because you leave the theatre and it's done. But the book, you know, I still get messages, you know, got a message yesterday about someone who had just read Paris or Die, and it was thrilling to think that the book, it has its own life. Last, who knows, you know, it could last. I just read Bonjour Tristesse again for the 80th time, and I'm like, gee, wouldn't it be nice if someone was reading my book?
I'm sure they will be. Jane, we have a lot of listeners that listen to this show that are writers themselves. What is the best or worst writing advice that you have ever received?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, of course, is write what you know. I mean, it's so obvious and so sad, but I really love to read what someone knows, and especially what's under your scab. You know, like, what is there? What do you know that's unique that doesn't, you know, and that's, I think, you know, another thing that I just read the other day that really got me is that is really releasing me at the moment is, you know, we have such a pressure to know what it is we're writing about, to have our elevator pitch. And I'm just savoring Helen Garner's her diaries, and I'm still on the yellow one. And there was just this moment in her diaries where someone says to her, "What's your book about?" And she says, "Oh, I don't know, love and pain." And it just really stuck with me. It was like, what else is there? I don't think it's not what else is there to write about, but it just released me because it made me feel like, oh, that's enough. You know, I don't have to have some clever pitch or clever idea. It can just be that I've written about love and pain. And, you know, reading her diaries is just such a great example of the way that story is intrinsic to us. We don't trust it enough, and we think we have to tell some grand story, but actually just love and pain is fine. So that wasn't a piece of advice as much as just a little pickup that I got that I thought, oh. The worst advice is always, for me, it was always things that got me right back up in my head, you know, that thing of, well, what is it you're trying to say? You know, what is it? Also, sorry to ramble, but I was just thinking this morning about how much pressure there was on me. You introduced my books as literary autofiction, which just makes me so happy because I felt so much pressure, and it really took a lot of years off me, being published, pulling my hair out, trying to figure out if I was writing nonfiction or fiction. Mm. Where did it fit? Fiction, is it nonfiction? And Alice Pung gave me, there was a festival down here in Geelong called the Word for Word Festival that was the nonfiction festival. And one year they had this theme that was fiction or nonfiction, and I was like, yes, I'm going to go. I'm going to find out what, you know, I'm going to find out. And no one really addressed it. It was so strange. I remember, anyway, there was a talk between Alice Pung and a few other writers. And at the end, I still didn't get the answer to my question. And I just put my hand up and said, I'm sorry, I just have this one question. What if you don't know if you're writing fiction or nonfiction? And she said, are you writing something? And I said, yeah, I've been writing this trilogy of books, and I just don't know if they're fiction or nonfiction. They're from a true story, but I've crafted them and worked them. They're not just a direct account of something. And she said to me, you don't have to think about that. You just write your books and let them figure it out. And that was a really great piece of advice. Yeah, it really made me think, because I feel like this question has come up a lot just from people around me who say a similar, I'm surprised actually, I thought it was only me, but I think there are quite a few people who are writing in that place that's a personal place, but it's memoir, but it's also, this is a genre that exists everywhere in the world. It's really normal. People have been doing it for a very long time. It's not new, but it just it's tricky to feel where you fit, and that can trip you up for a really long time, like it did. It definitely did for me.
Kate, I think you've got an article.
I do have an article this week. This came up on Twitter, shared by some Australian publishing people, I think, from memory, but it's called Where is All the Book Data? It's by Melanie Walsh. And so it's US-based. It's on the Public Books website, and it's part of a bigger series called Hacking the Culture Industries, which has been commissioned by these two people. Yeah, Laura McGrath and Dan Sinikin. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. It's so interesting. You know that you and I, for a long time, and the industry at large and the people we talk to, have been frustrated about the lack of kind of transparency and knowing the data. And it's something, it's part of the reason we started the podcast in the beginning was like, how do you know all the things that you're supposed to know about the industry, and how do you get all the data? So this article speaks to that frustration, and it focuses on the shift in over the last little while since the collection and use of book scan data, and how it has become central to kind of publisher decision making. So I'm just going to read a little bit from it because I think that this will speak to people. So she writes, to people who care about literature, data is often seen as a neoliberal bogeyman, the very antithesis of literature and possibly even what's ruining literature. Plus, people tend to think that data is boring. To be fair, data is sometimes a neoliberal boogeyman. It is sometimes boring, and it may in fact be making literature more boring. But that's precisely why we need to pay attention to it. So she goes into the fact that increasingly now, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, publishers will look at previous sales data before they acquire a new book. It becomes part of what happens in the acquisitions process. You might not get a third bite of the cherry if your first two books don't sell well, all of that stuff. And she just talks about the fact that that data is so hidden, but it needs to be available to more of us. And they've actually set up a kind of a website, data collection website, but it is a truly,
so interesting.
Yeah, truly interesting article. I recommend that people have a read. It's quite a long read. And then I followed up with another article in that collection on what makes a bestseller. And it's particularly in reference to the New York Times bestseller list and actually the criteria that is used to determine that, and the fact that it's editorial in some sense. And there's that whole hardcover, trade paperback kind of divide as well in terms of what is entered into the data. So all of this stuff is just stuff that I think we as authors need to be more active about asking our publishers and agents or the industry at large to say, can you please share the data with us? Can you tell us what's selling? Can you tell us the data that you're making decisions off? Because I think that that can only make it all kind of stronger. Anyway, train of thought, but I followed up all this stuff on bestsellers and read the New York Times article about Colleen Hoover, who is currently, I think she has 6 books in the New York Times bestseller list and in Australian lists as well. She is a writer who originally self-published, and then she had a book that was published during COVID, somehow took off on TikTok, and basically she's just exploded and all of her backlist has been republished. It's a really incredible article. And also, remember when we talked about the Taylor Swift theory, Ian's Taylor Swift theory about how you build that kind of fan base? And it was one of your guys that you follow who talks about the super fans.
Oh, yeah. Kevin Kerr something.
Someone. But anyway, this idea that it's actually her readers who have driven this explosion in sales rather than the marketing itself. So anyway, lots of super interesting things for people to follow up and read.
That's fascinating. Kevin Kelly is his name.
Kevin Kelly.
He actually does, I just had to look at because I had bookmarked, he does, maybe I've mentioned this before, he's got a couple of articles on his website. One is 69 pieces of advice, life advice on my 70th birthday. Have I mentioned this before? No. And then he does another one. But they're really great. They're really good. I'll link to them.
Pop
but
them
they're
in.
Really pieces of advice. We had a trivia question at work yesterday. We had a face-to-face, like a fun catch-up for the division. And the question was the number one best-selling book of all time. It was a multiple choice question. What do you
what
think?
Were the options?
Okay, so there was Harry Potter was an option.
Mm-hmm.
What else was an option? Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Don
Quixote.
Howdy.
Quixote.
Quixote.
Yeah.
And something else. Of those, what would you say is?
Well, I suppose I immediately want to say Harry Potter, but I'm figuring that that's the red herring here.
I said Harry Potter and very authoritatively, like, that's got to be Harry Potter. Like, got to be Harry Potter. It's Don Quixote. Coyote.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would be surprised about.
What was the, where was this data from? I would be really interested in the data here.
Well, yes, that's right. That's right. It was pre-book scan, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
So unverified.
Oh, yeah, do you find enormous pressure when there are literature questions and you are on a trivia team now? Like people turn
I do. I mean, I never do trivia. Trivia is not my, like, I'm terrible at trivia. But this, yeah, I probably wouldn't go in so authoritative. Next time. Harry Potter, how can it not be Harry Potter? But I guess there are also a lot of Harry Potter books. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And that. Don Quixote was written a very long time ago. So, you but know, it's more years in circulation.
Yeah.
I suppose.
I'm still surprised by it. I'm going to question that.
Good.
I'm going to go and see the data, go back to them.
What have you been reading?
Reading. One of the books I've been reading at the moment that I posted about it on Instagram is The Palace Papers by Tina Brown.
Oh,
I did not realize how excited I am about British royalty. It's so good. So she's a UK journalist. I got into this book through the How To Academy podcast. She did an interview with Pandora Sykes, which was a really good interview. This is a very long book. I have no idea how long because I'm reading it on Kobo, but it basically goes from Charles all the way through to the present day. So I guess the birth of Charles is kind of where it starts. There's not a heap on Queen Elizabeth prior to that. Oh my God. The minutiae, the like this contrast between the glamour and mystique maybe of royal life contrasted with the dullness of it. What she does really well is that she gives people personalities, which obviously they have, but they don't tend to come through. So you actually get a real sense of William, for example, and
yeah,
Kate,
right.
Like who they are behind closed doors. There are moments where you think, oh, you can see the author's point of view coming through, which I guess is inevitable. It satisfies this lovely gossipy need. It's really, I can't say how much I'm enjoying it. I do also, however, have this dual thought that I never, ever want anyone to write a biography about me. Obviously, very unlikely that's going to happen anyway, but, like, I guess she writes about William, for example, who's, you know, been raised in great privilege. And just some of the kind of the life events or the small things that happen or that you say as a child, as a teenager, when you're learning about the world, you know, that talks to the fact that he's been raised saying, you know, you're a great person, you're privileged and entitled and you see that coming out. But, yeah, it would be very hard to grow up in the public spotlight. A really tough thing. And inevitably she has sort of interviews with a range of people, but, yeah, your worst moments, I suppose, and candid worst moments. I mean, there's not heaps of that anyway, but... yeah, a very tough thing. The other one that I'm currently reading that I'm super excited about is Elizabeth Strout's new novel, Lucy by the Sea. This was such a nice surprise. I didn't realise. I thought she'd already released a book this year. This has only been out for a week or two. It features Lucy Barton. It's set in the world of COVID. It is objectively not her best work. Maybe it's too soon for COVID. I still love it. An average Elizabeth Strout is still an 8.5.
Oh,
I reckon.
It really is.
It's such a good book. I think I'll read it. I started it yesterday. I reckon I'll finish it today. So good.
Oh, that's so good. Adding to list immediately. I went on a deep dive I think that I spoke about Lydia Yuknovich last time we spoke, and what she, I'd done a course with her through corporeal writing, which she's part of. And I hadn't read her work, but I'd heard her on a podcast, the Crafting with Ursula Between the Covers series. And so I went deep on her work, and I started with her memoir, which is called The Chronology of Water. And it is exquisite. She is just the most extraordinary writer. It's about swimming. She's got a traumatic childhood. It's about becoming a writer. It's about love and breakup and so many things. And it's about writing. And there's this extraordinary quote, which I ended up putting up on Twitter, but I'll read, because I think I love this so much, and I think I could hold on to it as a kind of a mantra for writing life as well.
There is a love a mantra. Put it on a love a mantra.
I know there is a language warning for our listeners in this. So she says, "I wrote stories, I wrote books, but the more I wrote, the more I saw a door opening behind me, and I saw that if I jammed my motherfucking foot in it, more of us could get through, and that we could make things together. What we could make was art. How that mattered." Oh, I just thought that was so good. And she is that kind of person. Like, coming to her through corporeal writing, she's all about the community and collaboration and kind of remaking literature. Just so beautiful and just beautiful for the craft. And then I went on to the Book of Joan, which is this kind of post-apocalyptic, crazy, smart thriller. So good. So good. And so good that I went, in fact, and when I posted, Jacqueline Krupe from Hill of Content said, "Oh, we've got the hardcover of Thrust," which is her new book, which I've been waiting for to come in at my library. And I just went straight to Hill of Content and I bought it in hardcover, because I'm just, hardcover. I am a new massive fan of Lydia Yuknovich.
That's such a good discovery. Hardcover, big investment. Just spatially a big interest.
Just spatially. And I'm taking that one with me. That is part of the suitcase that I am taking. The other one that I read so quickly, because I did a train trip. I got on a train into the city and out of the city last week. And I actually read this book on that evening. So on the train in and the train out of the city. So 2.5 hours for me from where I live. I completely devoured this book, and it is Out of Breath by Anna Snopstra. And we actually talked to her in an upcoming episode. So good, thrilling, page turning, set up in the Kimberley, just has all the elements of a book that keeps you on the page. And when I posted about it, what I didn't realize is that our friend, the writer Anna Downs, who is the author of The Safe Place and The Shadow House, who we've spoken to on the podcast before, she's also an actor and she does the audiobook.
Oh, amazing.
Right?
How small a world is that? That's very Kevin Bacon.
Very Kevin Bacon. So I've read it in hard copy, but I assume that the audiobook will be sensational. So that's a recommendation.
Can I say two books I'm excited about?
Please do.
One is that I have in front of me, my microphone is resting on. One is Bridget Delaney's Reasons Not to Worry, which is all about stoicism. She wrote a couple of articles about stoicism when the pandemic first happened. I think it's going to be great. I loved her book, Wellmania, which I think you were saying is just sold into the US. Or is it on TV?
It's on TV. I'm pretty sure Celeste Barber's part of it. The production.
Oh my god.
And amazing. They've made the series, and I think that the series is just sold in I don't know, worldwide, whatever happens when it's outside Australia.
It's incredibly funny. So I'm looking forward to the marriage of stoicism and humor. But I started following a couple of Instagram stoic people. There's one, the Daily Stoic, who does little Instagram reels. They're very inspiring. Like, I've yet really to incorporate stoic practices into my life, but I'm very, it's really good. He has this 7-day, so it's the Daily Stoic, but he also has a website and you can sign up and get like a 7-day, you know, introduction to stoicism. Very good.
Maybe that's what I need for New Zealand. I need a
stoic. You do. It's incredible. I mean, I think about it a lot. I think Bridget was talking about it in terms of the pandemic, but I think in terms of climate change, I mean, there's action as well that you can do, but the stoic practice sounds. How to be stoic in chaotic times is the subtitle. The other one is Jock Sarong's book, The Settlement, This is a book I've heard so much about. It's set around the establishment on Flinders Island of this kind of mission prison for First Nations people. He's an amazing writer, just full stop. But I think this is a book that's really going to talk to and ignite debate on that kind of thing of who can write what stories.
Mm.
And it's a debate I'm interested in having. I don't want to be involved in. I don't want to be pillarized for anything. But I'm interested in hearing genuine debate about, you know, about yeah. the spectrum of opinions on that.
There's a really interesting article in The Guardian. It's a review of the settlement. It's by Michael Winkler, who wrote Grimish. It speaks to that. So yeah, very interesting. And yeah, I'm looking forward to reading that book as well. What have you been listening to?
I have one listen. It's a podcast called Hashtag Authentic. Which is by a woman called Sarah Tasker. Have you listened to her? No,
I have not, so but I am about to.
Well, she's a UK-based Instagram expert. Also someone with a 7-day free program, if you're into that sort of thing. I signed up for, never did anything with, but she's like Instagram is her thing if you want to crack Instagram. But she had a really recent episode with Farah Store. I think it was a former magazine editor, maybe Vogue, Elle, that kind of thing. But the podcast was about why you need to join Substack.
Mm.
So really insightful discussion for anyone that's thinking of starting a newsletter, which we are.
We are.
Long-time listeners might remember our former newsletter, which has been inactive for so long. We have now lost all those addresses. That was a MailChimp one. Having said that, though, the way they talk about it, Substack way more than just a newsletter. I'm trying to get my head around exactly how it works, but they talk a little bit about paid and unpaid options, but a lot about how people are using it. And often quite established writers are using it to grow an audience. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of commentary about how with Substack, as opposed to Instagram and Facebook, you own your audience in the sense that you have their email addresses. And so you can kind of do things with email addresses, I guess, that you know, Facebook and Instagram can't censor you, for example. But there's also this real intimacy to arriving in people's inboxes. So if you're thinking of a newsletter, if you've got a newsletter, the Substack one is the Substack episode is really worth a listen.
Oh, that's good. Research for us. Watch this space.
Very good. Very good.
I did go and listen to some of the podcasts that you recommended last time and had them in my ears and was very into some of the stuff, and I've got them ready for listening while I am in New Zealand. But the one the deep dive that I went on this week was by searching for Emily St. John Mandel, who is the author of Station 11, but most recently Sea of Tranquility, which I am halfway through and absolutely loving. It's blowing my brain. But I hadn't read it when I listened to her interview with Ezra Klein and also on the book show with Claire Nichols. And both of those interviews were ones that are great interviews, and they were ones that made me immediately go and get the book. And just her talking about how she has included, so talking about COVID, Sea of Tranquility involves a character who is an author who is on tour promoting her book about a pandemic, which Emily St. John Mandel was during COVID.
Yeah.
That is about a pandemic. So it's just very meta, kind of got a lot of autofiction in there. She talks about how in these interviews, she talks about how every interaction, and they are like so cringeworthy, that occurs in this author tour that she writes about, this fictional author tour, happened to her. Like,
I want to read that.
People in signing lines, you know, what cab drivers said at certain times, the questions she was asked by audience members. So just for so many reasons, great book, and highly recommend those two episodes, but also just the book show and Ezra Klein's show as well. Mm. Just great examples of interviewing as well.
This is just a slight, those interactions that you have. Someone at work yesterday came up and said, oh, I read your book. And they came over really excited and said, I read your book. And that's all they said. Have you had this experience as well? It's the worst. It's like, say another sentence.
Just keep talking. What did you say?
I just kept talking. I just said anything that came into my head. You have to follow those words up with another sentence.
Yeah, otherwise don't say the first sentence. Don't say the first sentence. I read your book and then full nothing. Stop.
The worst.
Oh, wow.
I have not been watching a lot, but I have a virtual event that I'm going to tomorrow, which is too late for anyone else to go to. But I found out, it is John Irving has a new book out. So ooh. John Irving, who wrote World According to Garp, Cider House Rules, A Prayer for Owen Meany, I thought he was dead. But he has just had a new book come out. It's got Chairlift in the title. I can't even remember the name of the book. But there is Simon and Schuster in, I think, New York, are hosting an event with John Irving, which is at 7 p.m. Thursday night their time and 10 a.m. Friday morning our time, which feels so exciting, like the opposite of real life events. But this is this nice thing about hybrid. But really what I wanted to mention about that was the reason that I heard about the John Irving book is that the Leaf Bookshop in Ashburton, which I know that you know, you've been there as well, it's a lovely bookshop. They're gorgeous. Massive supporters of writers. They have a great YouTube channel and they feature writers on it, but also Katie, who owns the bookshop, reviews books. And that is how I heard about the new John Irving book.
Oh, worth a follow. They do such a great job. Worth a follow. Yeah. Something else to follow on YouTube things that I wanted to mention is the Writing New South Wales YouTube channel, because I did that first Friday chat last week and there were lots of first-time podcast people there, which was delightful. But they pop those talks up on their YouTube channel afterwards. I'm not sure if mine's there yet or not.
That's great.
But, yeah, just really worth, again, these things that are now available to us that have – there's so much content out there and we had a really great discussion, fabulous interview with Rowena. So that's worth checking out as well. I have such an odd or out of character for me watching recommendation, which I know that you
I feel like I'm going to want to watch it.
No, I don't know that you will, but I have mentioned before that I live in quite a basketball household. Our two girls play basketball. My partner still plays basketball. And they were very excited to watch this week, The Redeem Team, which is just out on Netflix. Have you heard anything about this?
No.
Okay. So The Redeem Team is a documentary about the US men's basketball team and how they went from being the dream team when all the like massive, massive champions were playing for them. And then they came away from the 2004, I think, Summer Olympics with the bronze medal. They lost. I haven't watched the whole thing, but I was kind of going in and out and watching it. And it's so interesting about the psychology of teams and the psychology of going in assuming that they were winners. Like they are shocked when they lose. And everyone in the US is shocked and there's jokes about them. And this way that they then got in a new coach and had to train to become an actual champion team. Rather than you kind of individual champions.
Well, this is it.
Champions. Yeah.
You put the best individuals together. It's not necessarily a great team. I volunteered at the Sydney Olympics and I was a basketball kid, definitely. And I got the basketball stadium was where I was attached to. And I checked I was on you rotated from ushering to security and stuff, but I checked the Dream Team's security passes as they went in. Yeah. As they went onto the court, it was super exciting. I mean, I couldn't stop them. They walked straight past me, but that was my job.
Goodness. That makes you my eldest daughter in particular will just want to be in your presence because you have done that.
Oh my God. It was amazing. There was they had the rhythmic gymnastics on at the same place. And I remember I always regret having done this. There was a girl, I think she was Russian, and she'd come third in the rhythmic gymnastics. And I ran into her behind the scenes and she had her bronze medal on and she was crying because she was really upset. And I asked if I could hold it. Is that the worst thing ever? I still feel bad about it.
I don't even know what to say. What did she say? No, I think I probably would have done something similar.
She let me hold it. I was young.
How young were you?
Inappropriate. Not that young. 19.
This is a sliding doors moment. You know, the first thing that I thought when you said I volunteered at the Sydney Olympics, my immediate first thought was, oh my gosh, you could have been the Queen of Denmark. That is my immediate first thought. Because you could have run into the guy at the bar. Like that's wow.
Yeah, that was definitely my sliding doors. It was actually so much fun. It was this funny combination though, because you're either a student or a retiree. So you sort of had these, and you had little gangs, but they tended to be constructed. Because just because someone's a student doesn't mean you necessarily get along with these better. But you had these sort of mixed generational gangs that hung out together. It was very fun. It was great.
I did not know this. You know, this just makes me think we have so much more to learn about each other's past, Catherine and Colette. We really do. What have you got coming up?
I have an event at Eltham Bookshop. It is hosting an event with Alan C. Jones and his new book, Her Death Was Also Water. So it's on the 17th of November. You can book tickets. I will put a link in the show notes.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
That's very good. And I know that Eltham Bookshop also has an upcoming event with Els Fitzgerald and Grace Chan talking about their short stories, which will be really fun. So get along to that. We'll pop a link to that in the show notes too. And if there is anyone who is listening who will be at Verb Wellington, please do come up and say hello. I do not know if I haven't looked in our place-based stats recently, if we have any listeners in Wellington, but if there are, my goodness, I'm looking forward to meeting you. Please come and say hello. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.